This next speaker is an interesting character.
He is.
One way I can say that. he's definitely very entertaining to watch. Definitely very interesting. I really loved shooting this particular video with distinguished engineer James Whitaker.
Right.
Do you have any interesting stories about James you wanted to share very quickly?
Oh, I have many, but if I share them, maybe people won't allow him to talk to me anymore. So perhaps I will not.
Okay, you're totally able to take the fifth on that one there. Don't forget, all these sessions will be available on demand on Channel 9 at MSDN.com within 24 hours of watching them. We're now going to be talking about the rise of the machines with James Whitaker. The question for this one, do you want to go ahead and read this one for the question?
So this is an interesting one. In 5 years' time, what part of James's body did he expect to be the size? Sorry, did he expect the size of a computer to be? I'll tell you what my guess was, which is wrong. I guessed liver.
Okay.
Because James, like us, is a craft beer fan.
Could be.
That was not correct.
Yeah. So stay tuned for this video. We're coming up to it. And what, in 5 years' time, what part of James's body did he expect the size of a computer to be? Naz, roll the clip.
About the future of humanity. Let me tell you about the future of humanity. My name is James Whitaker. I'm a distinguished engineer at Microsoft. Here in my natural habitat, the Bellevue Brewing Company, speaking at the Microsoft TechNet virtual conference about the future. And I've become somewhat of a student of the future. So it turns out that the future is a disruption of the present. And the present is a disruption of the past. So to study the future, you've got to study the past. And the past in computing follows a pattern. It's a pattern as reliable as Moore's Law. And it's a 10-year pattern. You talk about the future, what you're asking is what's next, right? And it turns out that the future is a disruption of the present. And the present is a disruption of the past. And so really, to talk about the future, you've got to start talking about the past first. And I think there are really three kind of eras that we've been through that point us to where we're going. So the first one is the PC era. And let's be honest, the company we work for owned that era, owned it. Right, everything revolved around Microsoft in the 1990s. It was pretty cool to work at Microsoft in the 1990s. I mean, you know, the thing about the 90s that I really like is that everything was new. It wasn't that you were writing an app to replace other apps. You were writing an app to replace manual processes. And I mean, it was intoxicating. Everything you did was just new. It was fresh. It was golden. It sold like crazy. And that replaced an era of, you know, static computers and mainframes and things like that. But it's very difficult to own the present and the future as well. So when the web came along, let's face it, Microsoft missed it. You know, it was impossible for us to convince the world that the web was a Windows app. The web was the web. And now all of a sudden, the developer focus shifted from the desktop to the web. And that's, if there's a hint in understanding the future, it begins here. That where the developers go, that's where the future goes. And the developers began to go from the desktop to the web. And the cool thing is, I was a Google employee in 2009. When the web began to lose it, right? This third era from PC to web to mobile. And I remember the day pretty vividly. Larry Page called all his lieutenants together. He's like, oh, we've got this big problem. We need to talk about this. Things are changing and it doesn't look good for Google. And he showed us a bunch of data from iPhone usage. The iPhone, this was 2009, right? So the iPhone had been out for 2 years. And the data was conclusive. I mean conclusive. People who owned an iPhone weren't using a browser. They were consuming the web through apps. And Larry was just, you know, this was an end-of-life scenario for Google. Mind you, in 2009, Google made 97% of their income on people clicking on sponsored ads and sponsored links through a browser. If they're going to suddenly shift to consuming the web through apps, this is a big problem for Google. And it's stunning to think about this shift, because I don't think people give enough credit to Steve Jobs for what he actually did. People say, oh, Steve Jobs was this great storyteller, he was this great businessman, he was this great, we're still making movies about that guy. But his real insight that changed the world and that shifted the world from a web-oriented culture to a mobile-oriented culture was the App Store. The App Store, because that's what did it. Once we began to stop consuming the web through a browser and start consuming the web through apps, everything changed. Because if you think about it, apps are just better than the web. If you, let's say, so you like music, what are you going to do? Go search for all the music you want to find on the web and YouTube, or are you going to consume it through an app that specializes in music? Of course you're going to consume. That app does that for you. And you're into beer. A beer app is going to be way better than surfing the web through a browser looking for beer stuff. Right, Rick? Apps are better. And so you do notice at this point something really interesting happened, that browsers became much more app-like. And I don't think people give this enough thought, because I tell you, if you're going to understand the future, you have to understand those inflection points in the past. And this was a huge one. That shift from web to mobile happened because apps were better at surfing the web than humans were. The browser needed a human to consume the web. The app didn't. That soccer app, that beer app, that music app, they could consume the web while you were offline. They could be doing work on your behalf. And then as soon as you say, hey, who's playing tonight? I want to go see a band in downtown Seattle, because that's what you do. The app already knows who's playing there. The web has to say, oh, wait a minute, let's see, you're interested in music, Seattle, let me find all the links out there and put them all together. Apps are better. So there we go, from PC to apps to mobile, and it's really the App Store that did it. So the future, what's next? From the PC to the web, from the web to mobile, what's next? I mean, are we going to continue to require a screen like this? If you think about it, what does this screen even do for me? The screen allows me to tell my computing environment, hey, I want to do this, I want to do that. And then once my computing environment goes out and does that, it can tell me what it's done. This is a communications device between me and the computing infrastructure. Will I need that in the future? So the browser really needed me. In the web era, the human was front and center. The browser didn't do anything except wait for human input and just sit there, wait, what does my human want? I'm sitting here waiting. And the apps, not so much. The apps could go out and consume the web in advance and bring stuff to us and delight us with, how did you know? And now it's already beginning to shift again. Mm. And now the shift is, it anticipates us. Cortana, Siri, Google Now, they look at our calendars, what is my human doing today? And they can anticipate. And so, at some point, they're going to anticipate enough that I don't need this screen. I don't need to tell them, hey, I'm going here, give me directions. They know. Hey, I've got a friend's birthday or anniversary coming up. They know. And they can help me proactively. And so this is the next big shift. So check this out. When you look at the PC era, 10 years old. By the time the PC was already 10 years old before it became relevant. The web, 10 years old before it became relevant. Mobile, 10 years old before it became relevant. iPhones made it relevant, but BlackBerries, Windows CE, all this stuff existed before. And we're at that inflection point now. It's 2016. So what was happening 10 years ago? Well, in 2007, the iPhone came out, ushering in the mobile. 9 years. 2006, Amazon Web Services came out. So clearly, mobile and cloud are going to be huge in the future because they're 10-year-old technologies. But we can do so much more with them now. This idea, when Satya Nadella first said mobile first, cloud first, I literally thought the guy was insane. What is he talking about, mobile first, cloud first? What was it, a tie? Seriously, Satya, in America, we don't allow ties. No ties. No ties. None of our sports end in ties. Get out there and keep playing. Right? This is why we don't watch soccer, isn't it? We don't, because it ends in a tie. It ends in a scoreless tie. That is so un-American that I can't even get it inside my head. We don't like ties. So this whole mobile first, cloud first, what does that mean? Is it a tie? In a sense, but in reality, what it means is that mobile and cloud are combining, and the line between the two is being blurred, and technologies like Cortana and Siri and Google Now are responsible for this blurring. It doesn't need my input. It doesn't even need my voice input. It's able to do things for me that are actually quite stunning. So that means that in the future, this device accessing the cloud, working on my behalf behind the scenes, means that I don't need this screen. And if I don't need this screen, the amount of electronics in this phone are basically about the size of my finger. You're thinking, good thing he chose that finger, right? Good thing he chose that finger. Because if I take away the screen, I don't need all this battery, because somewhere between 73 and 78% of my battery is in service to my screen. And if I'm able to figure out what my user wants without the screen, all of a sudden the amount of electronics goes down. Follow Moore's law a little bit further, and you've got the amount of electronics in 3 years to about that. Follow Moore's law to about the 5-year point, and you're basically looking at the size of my fingernail being able to compute at the rate that this thing computes now, which means this could be a fiber that's sewn into, well, not that shirt, sewn into your bracelet, that watch in 5 years. Crystal could be a supercomputer. Those earrings could be computing. You could weave, well, you couldn't weave. You could weave computers into your hair, right? They're in the collar of your shirt. This hat could contain a bunch of computing potential on your behalf. And so once screens become optional, all of a sudden we have computers everywhere. And this is what we call the Internet of Things. And here's a hint, the Internet of Things is almost 10 years old. The Internet of Things really began to become real in about 2008, 2009. And so 10 years later, it looks like the Internet of Things is going to be pretty big. My beer glass should be able to understand when it's empty and order me another one. I might just code that myself when I'm done with this. Your shirt, if I like that shirt, I should be able to, you know, hey, I want that guy, that shirt I really like. And the computing in your power in your shirt can talk to the computing power in my band or whatever. Maybe it's a gesture, I don't know. And I can get one of those 3D printed at home in my size or whatever I want. The number of scenarios become when the world is a computer, when this chair is a computer, when the clothes you wear are computers, when the items that you're shopping for are computers, when your toaster is a computer, when your refrigerator is a computer, they'll be able to make decisions on your behalf. Refrigerators ordering food, your car being able to purchase fuel of whatever sort, your toaster being able to make an end-of-life decision. Which they will, right? Your toaster is going to break one of these days. In fact, it's probably going to realize it beforehand. It's going to realize, hey, something's wrong with me because I'm looking at all my data. Something's wrong with me, and it's going to go out on the internet of toasters, And the other toaster is going to say, oh, dude, look, your data shows that you're dying. You're dying. You got like 6 days left to live based on your data, because that data is really important. You know, if you are in a movie and there have been a lot of people in that same situation at the same time, and the computers are going to know, hey, people sitting here in this movie theater have accessed this sort of technology, this sort of, right? You're in this long 3-hour Hobbit movie and you need to pee. Other people have done the same thing. And we're going to be able to correlate all that data and understand that, hey, if people need to pee in the movie, this is the data they need to use to figure out at what point is the most boring part of the movie. Did you know that's actually in Azure? It's an app called Run Pee, and it's awesome, right? It tells you pee times at the movie. And so when your technology detects you in that time and in that place, it will be able to look out and see, what have all the other people at this time and at this place, what technology have they used to help them? So this is the era we face, this Internet of Things, this Internet of Everything, this rise in the machines. And the machines are going to get really, really good at predicting what we want and when we want it. In fact, I think they're going to get so good that they're going to be better than us at predicting what we want and when we want it. I mean, imagine being in a situation, here I am, I've got this what do I do? And knowing that everybody who's ever faced that situation, here's what they did to get out of it. Here's what they did to answer their questions. Here's what they did. All that data is going to be available. So I think this era of the machines is real. And at some point, those machines are going to get so good at doing things and so good at understanding, hey, you know, this guy's beer is getting pretty low. It's only a matter of time. And we've noticed that every time that his second or third beer gets low, he gets another one. When his fourth or fifth beer gets low, he generally staggers out and will need a cab, right? All of these things kind of just work. What happens when they get really good at things? What happens when the machines get better at predicting what we need than we are? What happens when the machines are better at building houses, better at driving cars? Because they will be, mind you. Your children, you're old. Maybe not your children. Your children or your children's children are going to look at you all and say, wait a minute, let me get this straight, Mom. You drove your own car? Are you insane? Do you know how dangerous that is? Do you know how many people die driving their own? I cannot believe you did this. That sounds so dangerous. It's like us looking at our parents and our grandparents and thinking, you hunted for your own food. Wow, where was Costco when you needed it? It's going to continue down that path to the point where the machines are better at predicting our own needs and wants and fulfilling them than we are. When the hot tubs order their own chemicals, when our toasters make an end-of-life decision to replace themselves with another toaster, what's left for humanity at that point? When computers can build things and computers can manage our schedule and tell us where to go and we don't have to make any decisions anymore, then what? Scientists call this the singularity, the point at which computers are simply better than us at making everyday decisions, at managing our lives, and then at some point, understanding that, hey, wait a minute, I'm smarter than you. That's the singularity. This beer is defective. I cry foul. Much better, my friend. If you do that again, it's a good way to die. Then what? When the computers are really... Actually, you know what? You ordered a better beer than I did, computer. Then what? What are we going to do? What will our careers be when the computers are better at building houses, better at collecting our garbage, better at doing math, better at understanding history, better at designing our cities, better at writing our code, better at everything we do. What will humanity do? I mean, it might be down to the point where it's just art. That's all we have. Here, I'm sitting at a table with a poet and a musician. Is that it? So it's just poetry? It's just music? Will the machines get better at poetry than us? Will the machines get better at music than us? When all is said and done, what will we do? When the machines do everything, what will we do? Is that it? Is that why we're legalizing marijuana across the nation? Is that we all need to be stoned for this future because there's literally nothing for us to do. They build our houses, they raise our kids, they educate our young. So this is the grand challenge for humanity. Do we become stoned artists or do we seek for something more? I think we seek for something more. I think at the core of humanity's soul, we're explorers. We seek the unknown. We will have a grand period of invention and exploration. I think using these magic machines, we will figure out how to heal our planet. We will figure out how to terraform our solar system. We will figure out what's beyond this solar system and how to get there. I think that using the power of these machines, we are going to understand what it means to truly be human, which is explorers, inventors, and we're going to do some amazing things. So I predict that in the future, the Internet of Things will create a fabric of intelligence that will raise our consciousness to a new level. And in fact, I think that we are going to be able to do things with these machines that seem a lot like the things that we attribute to God now, creating new worlds, creating new possibilities. I think that through the power of these machines, we will be able to invent a future where this planet simply works. I think we'll become a society of peacemongers, a society of inventors, a society of pushers of frontiers. I think we will become the people who make sure that our species populate the multiverse. That's my take on the future. My name is James Whitaker. I work for Microsoft, and now I drink beer. Thank you.
And we're back. We managed to actually wrangle some time with Dr. Whitaker.
I am just so busy, you know.
He corrected me. I tried to say, good to see you, Mr. Whitaker. He's like, that's doctor to you.
Doctor for you. Okay. She can call me anything she wants.
Oh, nice. Well,
first
yes,
of all,
including that, too.
Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, man, no problem,
questions. Rick. I really appreciate it, man. Now, we did have a question for everybody that was watching the stream online. And this one is a little bit interesting. It's still safe for work. Do you want to go ahead and ask the question?
Yep. So the question was, in 5 years' time, what part of James's body did he expect the size of a computer to be?
An actual computer?
Yeah.
Right? Because this is a computer, too, right?
Yeah. Right.
What did you
So Moore's Law is, is this a quiz?
Yeah, you have to answer your own question.
Oh, my fingernail.
Fingernail.
Yeah. Fingernail was correct.
I got it. So you all think I'm making this stuff up? Is that what
Yes, we do.
I didn't know this was a test. I would have studied.
Well, we do have some live questions for people to go ahead and ask.
All right,
but I thought I would,
away.
You know, we do have Mary Jo here, so I thought I'd give MJ the ability to ask the first question. And I do want to remind you that we do not have a 7-second delay or a button to delete stuff. So please be safe.
As if I've ever needed one. I'm insulted.
No.
Nice.
No.
Go ahead, MJ. What's the question you have for Mr. Whitaker?
I have so many questions for James, but I guess
I hope the answers match. That's my only hope.
Well, the first time I was really exposed to you was when you wrote that infamous blog post when you left Microsoft and you came back from Google.
Mm-hmm.
So my question for you is, how are you finding Microsoft?
I like to say I didn't I cheated on Microsoft for a period of 3 years. That's the way I like to put it.
Right. Yeah. You were okay. You
just a little case of infidelity.
Nice.
But, you know, therapy, we had that talk.
Good.
Everything's
good.
Yeah,
you're good now.
Yeah, everything's good now.
They let you ride the shuttle. They don't let me ride the shuttle. But, okay.
I love Microsoft. It's a great place to work. So I'm giving this talk now. You know, Satya is all about culture. It's
right.
all about culture.
Yep.
I mean, you ask Satya a question, what do you do as CEO? And he will tell you culture is the only thing that's important.
Right.
And so I've been working with him on that, been giving my own growth mindset talk, which sounds like corporate Kool-Aid. But when I give it, it's much more like corporate Cascale. So,
delicious.
But it's really kind of cool to see the transformation that Microsoft's making. You know, the CEO and how much of his personality is really leaking out into the company at large. This is a great time to work for this company.
So you're not leaving anytime soon again.
Well, one never knows.
One
you know.
Knows.
We'll have to see
how
this
predict
goes.
Infidelity? I don't know.
As it goes.
They got to keep them on their toes,
you
right?
Do.
If they know
you
I'm.
Do.
You know?
Yep.
So Joe has a question here from online, from the forums. And Joe's asking, how long until we can't tell the difference between humans and computers?
Okay.
That's probably a question you get a lot.
That's a good question.
It
so
is.
If you look at my Medium.com blog, I'm at DocJamesW on both Twitter and Medium. I actually predict that in the rise of the machines. I see a three-pronged battle, right, where we say separate from machines. We completely merge with machines, right? So, you know, we have electronic parts. We're already doing it with, you know, we can replace joints and we can replace, it's going to be to the point where we can replace eyes and you know, $6 million man kind of stuff. And so it's separate together, and then, you know, they kill us and it's them. Them and not us. So I think we will always be able to tell the difference between humans, because in that I predict that we win in that blog post. So check it out.
All right.
And the way we win is kind of interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. So
go check out the blog post for more details. Yes. Joe, good question. It's up there. Mm-hmm. Do you have one from the Twitters you wanted to pull before
we
go to the pool?
Yeah, although one, I see one on our teleprompter.
Okay,
like.
Go ahead.
I'm curious about James's view on this. How does AR and VR factor into the future, and how will they change IT?
Yeah,
specifically
how will they
IT?
Change
right.
IT? Okay,
right.
So let's talk about that. So I do predict the end of the screen, right? I don't see a future where we're still carrying these screens around. And I don't know, is it going to be 5 years? Is it going to be 10 years? It's going to be. Because, you know, the input, the screen is input-output. It allows me to tell my machines what I want. Our machines are going to get really good at detecting that. I mean, really good at figuring that. That's what the next version of these machines are going to be. What can I do for my human? What can I do for my human?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much data out there. Other humans in this exact situation, what data did they use from the web? What apps did they use from the cloud? And your device is just going to manage that for you. It's going to continue to get better and better at that until we don't need to tell our device and our device doesn't need to tell us what to do. But we still need screens for, you know, our weekly one-on-one.
Exactly.
I want to see that face, because you never know what glasses are going to be on it. And so that's when I think AR will be more important than VR, because it's a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
It's the real world, and it's anchored in the real world, too. And I don't know if people understand the physics of just how important that is. VR is completely artificial. And so the brain has a hard time interpreting what's going on.
Right.
AR, there's grounding in the real world. There's things that your the physics of your eye are used to. And then, you know, what we do in HoloLens is just kind of fake it.
Right.
Right? We make it look like there's light bouncing off of something there just by fooling your eye into it. So I think it's going to be much more stable. So you can pop up screens whenever you want.
Oh, I just got a really good
with
one
IT,
for
though,
on Twitter.
But with IT, though, I mean, it's mostly going to make traditional kind of IT go away. I mean, retreating into the data centers, retreating into the clouds, companies won't have IT people anymore. The cloud companies will have IT people in the future. All right, what'd you get from Twitter?
Oh, man, this is good. Ken Sachs, this is a great question. What areas of tech would you advise a tech-savvy 14-year-old to begin to pursue now to be successful in 2020?
This is a great question.
That's a great question.
And people just don't ask that enough. They don't think about the future. They think, oh, my kid's going to high school. They're taking STEM classes and college prep. The truth is, we have no clue what even eighth graders are going to be doing when they graduate, because the world is going to be completely different. But what they can be doing now is you got to pay attention to what's going on in the industry. You know, these 3 years ago, Google and Microsoft and other companies popped up and had this data scientist position. That's a hint.
Yep.
Data science is really important. And you know, there's things like even the softer skills like growth hacking. You know, pay attention to what people like you and other people who, I mean, this is your job.
Yep.
You watch the industry. So I don't have to watch the industry. All I have to do is read your stuff and all the other stuff out there and start predicting where it's going. So it's not about me giving you a list of things that they should do. It's about paying attention to the industry and understanding at any given point what's important and where it's going. You can get good at predicting this stuff. Do you all play the disruption game? Do you all ever do this? Sit around over a bunch of beers and just pick an industry and talk about how to disrupt
That's
it.
Cool.
Like we did, the last time we played it was with the insurance industry and how the insurance industry might be completely disrupted by a screenless machines everywhere, Internet of Things future. Freaking cool phone, by the way.
It's a nice case.
It's really cool. Yeah. And then I did it with education, and that's my South by Southwest talk, by the way.
Like
we played the disrupt game on education, and we came up with just some, I think, just world-shattering ideas about the future of education. So anyhow, teach your kids to think about the future. Teach your kids to understand what's going on now. What are all the inflection points in the past, which was what I talked about in my TechNet talk. And get them to be good at it and take ownership of it themselves. But you know, the hints about data science and machine learning and stuff like that, it's way more important than factoring trinomials.
I've got one here from Mike from the online forum. He's asking about how does technology reconcile with privacy?
Oh, privacy question!
You know it was coming.
You have to get one.
The privacy question.
You know, Tim could have handled this one, but Tim wasn't here to answer this one.
This one, I mean, this is tough. It's the promise of taking this data and doing completely magical things with it, and the idea that it can be hacked. By the way, in my blog post about the future, I do talk about how security is going to get easier in the short-term future, right? That the machines are going to remove humans as the weakest link. That's kind of cool. that you take humans out of the equation and let the machines manage all the data. You know, last year more machines were online consuming and producing data on the web than humans for the first time, and it's just going to get better and better and better. So there's going to be a period of time where security is going to get kind of easy because the machines are going to be managing it. The weak link of people is going to be removed, right? Short passwords and all that stuff. Like you got 6 passwords. I know you got 6 passwords, and you cycle through them all the time.
No, I actually use a password logger.
I use a
device.
But you think about people who don't understand how to do that.
Yeah,
you got
true.
4, 5, 6 right. passwords. They cycle through them. But then, of course, it's going to catch up because security, if the machines really do take over, we will have to hack their ass. And then we're going to be fortunate, really fortunate, that there are this impossible situation of security. So I think this is a societal level question.
Yeah,
you know, we need to talk about this. It's not a, hey, here's this situation. Is it private or is it not? It's too nuanced, right? I give this in my talk. I give this, you know, this privacy spectrum, the NSA on one end where everything is opaque and we don't really know what value we're getting, to Santa Claus on the other end where everything's open and we know exactly what value we're getting. And it's this spectrum that we need to include in the discussion.
Yep. Any other ones from Twitter you want to bring up?
I like this one from Gezay.
Okay.
Because it's a good segue off of what you just were talking about. In the future, can computers really do anything without human input? Man, and if so, what's the role of the human?
You know, this is what we really should talk about at Worldwide Partner Conference in Toronto. We should just do a whole thing on the future because this is some fascinating
stuff. That's great stuff, yeah.
So that's really the question. I mean, there is kind of part of me that believes that this is why we're legalizing marijuana, right? All over the Canada's like, oh, get high, in Washington, Colorado, because we're going to need something to do with machines doing all the work for us. We might as well be stoned. And so you do kind of get this sort of, you know, Aristotle, Socrates kind of, let's all sit around and think deep thoughts. I actually think this is going to be the grand generational challenge for humans, is to get back in touch with our humanity. Once the machines can do all of these tasks for us, what are we going to use all this brain power to do? You know, explore the cosmos.
Right.
And we really are. We're explorers at heart. The human race is explorers at heart. And I think that's what it's going to allow us to do.
Should we do one more, or do we have to start the next one?
Let's do one more.
Okay, well, last question. Last question. We got to stay on track.
Wow. Last question?
You're good, man.
Come on. Is the next stuff going to be as fun as me and Mary Jo? Seriously?
We're getting a lot of...
We should let Twitter vote. You all want us to keep going?
We're getting so many interesting philosophical questions for you.
Yeah.
Which is really fun.
Philosophy's good.
Here's one. Aaron Kozort. Soul is the essence of human, right? So is it an essential element in the answer? Sorry, is an essential element in the answer to you? But it will also be the flaw. So he's asking about machines, soul, right?
Like, will machines ever get a soul?
I guess kind of along those lines. But is soul also the flaw? Is the question. So he's asking a very big.
This might require some beer for this.
It might. It might.
You know, there is actual scientific evidence of a soul. Right, in just the simple right. terms of weighing people the moment they die, mm-hmm. and we find they instantly lose. What the hell right. is going on here, right. right? But we don't know how that has evolved, and so mm-hmm. Machines are not going to evolve like humans. They're going to hyper evolve. They are going to get good, you know, on Moore's law sort of generational. They're going to evolve on a Moore's law mm-hmm. scale, which is much faster than any of us evolved, mm-hmm. especially you, my friend.
Oh, thank you.
He's a drummer. What can I say? what, you know, when the human, so here's the thing, the bottom line with machines is none of them have ever done anything more than what they're programmed to do. Mm-hmm. And so the development of a soul, unless we program it, it's going to have to occur spontaneously.
Right.
No machine has ever done anything spontaneously. This is why my time frames for all this are much mm-hmm. more than Kurzweil's or anyone else's, because a computer has never done anything except obey its programming. That's step one. We don't know how to get a computer to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm going to basically say that I'm pretty sure that your session is going to be one of the most rewatched on-demand versions. And so all these sessions are going to be available on demand.
Hey, follow me on Twitter. I say interesting shit all the time.
He does.
What's your Twitter handle again?
Career limiting shit, as a matter of fact.
What's your Twitter handle again?
Is Doc James W.
You got it, Doc James W.